And for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to put in a prayer request. If we haven't had this publicized or anything yet, then we haven't had a whole lot of information, but my friend and the father of Sean Tuck, Jim Tuck, had a serious condition here several weeks ago, and for which he was hospitalized and is now undergoing physical rehabilitation therapy, still in a hospital. So that's all I have for you, but I got an email from Jim the other day and reminded me, and I didn't realize how serious the situation was several weeks ago, but he has been in several different, as I understand it, from one hospital to the other one closer to home. Sean could probably fill in a little bit later, but at any rate, I think all of us know Mr. Tuck and appreciate him, and he's been a wonderful servant for many years, so I'll just ask for your prayers on his behalf as well. Have you ever stopped to think about how much your life is regulated by some type of government, whether it's local, state, federal? Some of you are in business, and obviously you have to comply with oodles and oodles and bunches of different regulations. And anybody that is in business is subject to a certain amount of regulation. I know that in my job, I'm subject to a lot of regulations, and the fines for disobedience to those regulations and laws can be extremely steep. We have the distinction. My company has a distinction. I wasn't a part of it. It happened before I came on board. Has the distinction of paying the largest fine to the FDA for improper detailing of a pharmaceutical product, billions of dollars, just an unbelievable amount. And so the company paid it. They certainly contested it because who wants to ante up over $1 billion, but it's the highest penalty ever paid. And it comes from a company that has prided itself for over 140 years of really being the originator of a lot of these regulations. Several months ago, I was asked to speak at a class at the University of Arizona. I did a little independent research on my company, and I found out that they were the ones that actually in the early 1900s pushed through the laws and the rules and the regulations so that a physician would have to issue a prescription in order for a person to actually get a pharmaceutical. Of course, the pharmaceuticals weren't as advanced back in 1900 as they are now, but they were responsible for doing it. They're also responsible for helping set up the precursor to the Food and Drug Administration. So it's ironic that they find themselves on the other side of the law, 100 years later, and have to pay huge fines for improper promotion of a product. But that's the law, and it is a matter of something that we have to subject ourselves to, and it's a matter of control. I think if you were to analyze it closely, you'd probably find that a lot of what you do on a regular basis, on a daily basis, is ruled and regulated and governed by some form of government, either local, city, state, or federal. And you know what? I think all of us would be the first to admit that a lot of what we're regulated by is probably good. And it's, not probably good. It is good. A friend of mine from Boston who transferred here with our company is amazed every time he drives on Speedway near Walmart at Kolb and Speedway as to how fast people travel on Speedway. The speed limit is only 40 miles an hour. And yet he says, I regularly see people, they must be going 20 miles faster than I am on there. He says, they don't drive the speed limit in Tucson. I said, well, our traffic is, we think it's so bad because anytime we see an open stretch of road, we'd have to gut it, So, but it is kind of interesting. But for society to function, it has to be governance, right? I mean, would you agree that there has to be forms of governance and laws and rules and regulations? And, of course, there's always, if you're on the side that's being controlled, manipulated, standardized, or whatever, there's always the overreach many people think of those rules and regulations, whether it's the federal government or whoever it is. And it adds to the cost of doing business. Sometimes these things are just bureaucratic, needless rules and regulations that really don't benefit anybody at all, but just seem to clutter up the landscape and clutter up the legal system. And in the United States, we have sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, experience the experiment of how much control will the individual, because we are a nation of individuals, allow governments to exercise over us. Exactly what is the balance? And sometimes, as a nation that once about 150, 60 years ago went through a civil war, kind of equally divided, North versus South, we sometimes have through our history been still divided. Sometimes about 50-50, some 60-40, you know, it varies from election cycle to election cycle. But we kind of grapple with this issue of how much government is necessary, how much is needful. And it is one, actually, that man has struggled with for a long time. And what should a Christian's viewpoint be in it? Because Christians have lived under virtually every type of government there is, or there ever has been, and they have sometimes flourished, sometimes they've had to go under cover, so to speak. But it's a question that the Bible addresses in one way or another at many different times, but 1 Samuel 8 is one of the times in which this was a formal appeal to an individual who was in charge as to how much government should play a part in the roles. And I'll have to admit that after being in the church for 40 years, I remember hearing sermons at the feast on Isaiah 9 and 6 and how the government of God is going to grow and grow and grow, and then hear an explanation of, and this is many years ago, in John 14, in my palace are many mansions, or in my government or in heaven are many mansions, so on and so forth, you know, just like almost explained at the time as if it was some giant bureaucratic grouping of offices that never ends and goes on for all eternity, where there will be rules and regulations that will subject all humanity, and that government is going to grow. God loves government. And I've heard sermons that have been such an incredible endorsement for big government. And, you know, I had to rethink that over the years. But this issue came up in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 1. And we'll cover this entire chapter here a little bit. But it says, "It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But problematic here. His sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." Here we find an instance of, it may not be the first, but one of the first occasions in the Bible, which really is an expose of human nature, that somebody gets in control, and all of a sudden, they're on the take. You know, where there are movies that are made about this. One of my favorite movies, The Godfather, is huge on this factor of buying politicians and buying judges and buying influence. And yet, here it was in a society that we may have looked upon as kind of primitive, but it was still a society, it was still a nation of millions of people, and two people who were in prominent positions were taking bribes and perverting justice. And we hear the old saying, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know. And if you have an official that's in a highly placed position, and sometimes, guess what? All those horrible bureaucratic rules that enslave and enforce others might actually, if you know the judge or you know the politician, might not even apply to you, right? Such is the inequity of man's government. So suffice it to say that verse 1 describes a situation in which there were real problems of governance. And you can imagine the inequity that could occur under such a situation. In fact, the inequities still occur whenever there is man's government. Do you remember, anybody ever heard of Martha Stewart? Martha Stewart. Yeah, who hasn't heard of Martha Stewart in this day and age? And you know that Martha Stewart went to jail several years ago. And you know why she went to jail? Does anybody remember why she went to jail? It was insider trading, right? And she actually, I can't remember if she sold the stock short because she got an insider tip. But when you sell short is you buy the shares at a lower price for selling future when – how's that work? It's very complicated. But anyhow, she bet on the company going downhill based on the results of a clinical trial in which apparently the drug would not do well and the stock price would fall. And she bet that way. And it was found out that she did. And she was prosecuted by – a horrifically mean-spirited district attorney in New York who eventually, I think, went to prison himself because he was not really a bad guy, but he was trying to be the people's champion, and he eventually was in prison himself. But so I always wondered about that because in recent days and weeks and months, we've heard this in the news that people who are making laws, congressmen, senators – I didn't really know this until it came out in a CBS 60 Minutes report several months ago that they've never been subject to insider trading rules. So they can write legislation that may benefit their friends in industry or whatever, pick the winners and the losers. And that's why a lot of people go to Washington, maybe just kind of average wage earners, not really wealthy, and then 20 years later they emerge from Congress as multimillionaires because they have never subjected themselves. They've kind of, like they do so many things as lawmakers, they don't make themselves subject to the rules that they enforce for the rest of society. That's kind of called hypocrisy, right? And not an indictment against them per se, but here's somebody that, you know, I don't really like Martha Stewart. I don't even dislike her. I really don't have any opinion about her, but she seems to be kind of a nice person that can arrange flowers for you if you want to. You kind of like to invite her over to the house and, you know, change the valances out or maybe the blinds or something. I think she'd probably be really good at that and help us with it, but I don't hate her or anything. But then she went to jail for something that's commonly done by other members of society. And it just recently has come out, it's come to show us that, you know, no matter what government you live in, there's always plenty of hypocrisy and favoritism to go around. And this is what was happening at this time in Israel, because if you were a friend of one of the sons of Samuel, then, you know, life might be pretty good in an ancient kind of way. It might be going good for you. You probably could, gain, you know, wealth through some sheep trading or something, a favorable position in the marketplace or whatever. I don't know. Maybe one of these judges could make it possible for you to get a rye field on the cheap or something, you know, and just have a great harvest. But there were real situations that demanded that something be done. So all the elders, verse 4, gathered together, came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you're old," meaning we know this guy's not going to live for a long time after this, and, you know, we better do something now, because if we don't, you know, his judges are going to kind of be grandfathered, so to speak, into the position of the head of the nation under this system that they had, and, you know, we can't live with that. "Your sons do not walk in your ways." You just can't hide hypocrisy, no matter what the society, no matter what the government. "So make us a judge like all the nations," because that's worked out really well everywhere else. Yeah, it really didn't. I mean, you know it didn't, but they invited on themselves all of the problems, it seems, the problems of the monarchy, which seem to be preferable to the problems of these two unjust judges. Now, I'm sure that there was discussion. It took place for quite some time, bantering back and forth. But from what we gather, there doesn't seem to be real animosity towards Samuel. Maybe a little disrespect for his office in one sense, and I'll get to that. But they analyzed that Samuel wasn't going to live much longer, And that before he died, we had to do something here. And unless a change is made, maybe it's going to turn out really worse. Because when you have somebody that's evil, that's in, you know, Samuel at this time, let's face it, was kind of a figurehead in some ways, but he's holding the whole thing together because he was at least a righteous man. His sons were kind of operating under the surface, and you know, he's basically somewhat oblivious to what is happening. But we go on in verse 6. It says, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to just judge us. Now, the request displeased Samuel, but maybe it shows some short-sightedness and problems that he had as well, right? That wasn't really in control of his sons. But then how you could say, well, how do you control free moral agents? How could he have dealt with his – he could have dealt with his sons in a more appropriate way. But the answer is really, when you get down to it, they weren't self-governed. And when you get down to it, that's the problem of all government, when there's lack of self-control. But we, you know, as long as we live in this age and in this world, you're going to see this replicated time after time after time after time after time. It's one of the major problems that face society. And what does a Christian do in living within that? How do you react to that? So now, hold up a bit. Put yourself in the place of these elders of Samuel's day. What course of action should you have taken? This is really something that is kind of a teaching moment for any Christian. What should you have done? And you're formulating your ideas and probably furiously thinking and scribbling down things that you could have done. And yet, if they were men of God, certainly they would have prayed about it. They would have thought about it before going. And maybe some did. Let's be fair with them. We don't know. I don't know if they were men of God. They were elders of Israel. I'm not sure that they were led by the Spirit of God. It doesn't say it. It doesn't say it wasn't. So we just have to deduce that maybe because of the results, maybe they didn't. That's my opinion. I'll label that as opinion. But what would you do had you had the chance to do it? Because you may come up with the right answer right now, but do you always do it? Because I guarantee you everyone has had an opportunity like this in life, somewhere or another. Somewhere or another. And you will if you haven't. So let's wipe the slate clean here. Everything is blank. No judges, no judgmental anything. What do you do now if you have the responsibility, opportunity to do it? They thought it was a good idea to go to Samuel en masse like that. But, you know, it could have been handled a different way. And maybe the result would have been the same. I don't know. That's the chance you take. Sometimes the result, even if you take the right action, isn't always the rest. But you can at least, you know, be thankful that you know that there is a process in place. And there's a process in place within the law. This is my evaluation. They could have done something different because the law was always there and the law was known. They should have known it. I mean, there were copies of the law and there was the teaching of the law. There was a judge, at least one of them, that was righteous. And had they been a nation that was fully governed by the law of God, as they should have been, and I'm saying that they probably weren't, and there wasn't the knowledge of the law that there should have been, but they could have reached back into the five books, the Torah, and they could have found an answer. Okay, what do we do in this situation? The law of God is general in the sense that you can apply it, and there is what some people would probably say some New Testament theology there that they could have applied. And if you'll hold your place there, turn to Leviticus chapter 19, verses 16 and 17, you'll see a principle that could have been applied in this situation. They could have extracted this law and say, okay, let's think about the law. What could we do? And so this is something that is covered in Matthew 18, but it's something that was there in Leviticus chapter 19. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You don't want to put yourself in a position of controversy with your neighbor. It says, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. So the law says you have a responsibility to your brother. Christ elaborated on that law and said that anyone who is in need is our brother. And so you could be responsible for bearing the penalty of sin if you don't do what the law demands of you. So this was a law that was predicated on love and seeing somebody go in the wrong direction. And obviously Samuel was allowing something to go in the wrong direction. His sons were going in the wrong direction. Yet nobody really had the solution, and they didn't do this. So I'm saying that's one thing they could have done. I try to put myself in an example of the Bible and say, okay, and believe me, there are so many times when I haven't done the right thing. I've probably learned more by mistakes than anybody else because, wow, okay, you get bruised up a little bit. And certainly, I'm not telling any stories here, certainly in marriage, wow, what a chemistry lab of doing the right and the wrong thing. I'm trying to figure out, okay, 50%, have 50% of the decisions I've made in working with my wife been right? Have 50% been wrong? I'm sure she could tell us if she were here today, but she went to Sierra Vista, and she's resting comfortably, and she needs her rest very, very much. And so she deserves her rest very, very much. So if you want to let any rumors get back, then let that one get back to her, okay? So they didn't do what the law demanded. And so Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Now, of course, that rejection didn't begin at this particular time. It'd been going on for hundreds of years. You know, all you... That is a very sensitive microphone, isn't it? All you have to do is go to the beginning of the book of Joshua and take a look at what happened when they came into the land and the disobedience of law there. God said, basically, clear out the land. You know, the people would be driven out. All they had to do was have faith. They'd be driven out with bees and hornets and, you know, wild animals and whatever. They didn't obey God. None of that happened. And they continually had a fight on their hands. And then they basically amalgamated beliefs of the peoples that remained along with God's beliefs. And then over a period of a couple of hundred years, then, you know, what do we find at the end of the book of Judges? It says, every man did what was right in his own eyes. You know, the individual is subject to very little rules, regulations, no OSHA, no FDA back in those days. We can at least track historically. no worries about clean water, clean air, all that sort of thing. So not as much regulation, but certainly they weren't a very law-abiding people according to God's law. They were still God's people. But so they looked to one solution, and it says there was no king in Israel in those days at the end of the book of Judges. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everybody kind of coming up with their own standards, maybe some of it loosely affiliated with laws, rules, regulations, and not what God intended at all for Israel. And you know, was this totally a bad thing that there was going to be a king? No, not in that sense, but God allowed it. God knew that it was going to happen eventually because his son eventually descended from those kings of Judah. So in verse 8 of Samuel, it says, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they're doing to you also. One man, as great as Samuel was, just not enough, traveling from town to town throughout the cities of Israel, one man's obedience is not enough. It has to be every man's obedience. Every man has to study and become an expert in the law of God, not just one guy. I mean, that is really one of the great lessons of the book of Judges. It's really not a matter of whether it's a judge type of governance, whether it's led by a king, but every man, every woman, everybody in the nation of Israel has to become an expert in how the law exerts its influence over he or she. So they forsake them. They forsook God. And the main way they did that, because they didn't have contact with God on the basis that Samuel did in visions, dreams, whatever, but they had the opportunity to have contact with the law of God. And They didn't. A principle that we can extract is that maybe, I'm not going to say this universally, so don't write it down. People generally get the kind of government, this has been the observation of historians, people generally get the kind of government that they deserve, right? And sometimes it's there to teach a lesson. Sometimes it's maybe for the individual that's bright enough to realize that, hey, I am different. Maybe it's just for them to learn how to endure. But there are consequences to the choices that we make. And Samuel tried to indicate to those elders that this is what's going to happen. And that is exactly what happened and was repeated over and over again, hundreds and hundreds of times, not only in this nation of Israel and Judah, but in virtually any other nation that was governed by a monarchy. Just choosing one form of government over another doesn't necessarily eliminate your problems. So going on in verse 10, so Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He'll appoint captains over thousands, captains over his fifties, and set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. And he'll take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he'll take the best of your vineyards and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. And he'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he'll take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to his work. And he'll take a tenth of your sheep, and you'll be his servants, and you'll cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. And that was an additional taxing on people, the first record of individual taxation that we see in terms of Israel. There was a tax in, obviously a type of tax in Egypt when Joseph saved the nation of Egypt, a seventh for 7 years in order to prepare for something. But this was outside of the tithes and the offerings commanded in law. And so Samuel is telling him, you know, this is not really going to work out so well for you because all that you have, government is going to take. Because this is what kings do. And there's an absolute right of the monarchy that what they feel is right is God's will, and you just have to obey it. And for how many millions and billions of people throughout man's history have they lived under what is known as the divine right of kings? More people will wake up in the great white throne judgment who have lived under that kind of system perhaps than any other, certainly more than have ever lived in democratic states. Millions and billions of people have been governed like this, and Israel was just now falling in step with the rest of all of the other nations, and up until several hundred years ago, up until the 1800s, many nations were still governed by monarchies, and the idea that there's one person from a succession of families who knows better for you than virtually anybody else, and he, she is going to take these things from you, and he's going to extract this wealth from you, and they are going to become fabulously wealthy, and where we have the expression, live like a king, you know, I mean, because they really did. Now, primitively, by the standards that everyone in this room lives in today, but luxurious kinds of wealth, and the separation between the kings and the monarchies and between their subjects was vastly different. And in Israel, it began here and became a part of, you know, their legacy. And Samuel was able to correctly predict what would happen to them because, after all, this is the way of monarchs. And it began to be the way of monarchs soon after the flood. You know, right at the Tower of Babel, right with Nimrod, the first monarch that the Bible talks about. It may not have been the first one, but the first one with the kind of power and protection where people just cede over individual liberties and cede over all of their wealth for protective purposes. And then you had a great big walled structure going up where, and it's really, when you get back to it, it's all anti-God. It's anti-law and it's anti-God. We're not going to listen to you. I mean, it's not the shaking of the fist type of thing, but it's basically based on that. There is no God, and we have to rely on somebody else to take care of us. And even through many of the monarchies, especially, they traced a lot of their power, of course, in Europe to the church. And the church was kind of the enforcing mechanism of that power. And, you know, for many centuries, the popes were the ones who chose those in the royal families. And there was this insidious relationship between the church and the state. You kind of read about those things, haven't you? And it's kind of, we'll read about them in the Bible here in just a little bit. But today, we're not subject to that stuff. We're subject to every other kind of arcane bureaucratic controlling mechanism that can be possible in anybody's life. But we have it easy compared to these folks that grew up under the lives of monarchies. Now, we see the vestige of the royal family and the last royal wedding that we saw. I mean, you've got a beautiful woman, a handsome man. Everything is beautiful. They're, you know, going into Westminster Abbey, a wonderful, beautiful, flowing white, beautiful bride's gown and everything else. And then all of the pomp and the circumstances and the carriages, and it's lovely. And it's beautiful, and that's what we see. And we, you know, I mean, come on, everybody, well, many people do watch it, and with awe and amazement, they're interested. I mean, you will never probably ever meet someone of the royal family of England. Now, you might. I mean, it's, you might know somebody. I mean, the 6 degrees of separation, you'll probably know somebody that knows somebody that met one of the royal family. They're fabulously wealthy, even though they don't really have the might of rule and power and that sort of thing. That kind of died out, you know, in the 1800s, but they still had a certain influence and power and respect. I don't know if any of you saw the movie. I thought it was a really excellent movie, The King's Speech, where King Edward is a stutterer and his brother abdicates the throne because he marries outside of the royal family. He marries an American, and, you know, his brother is thrust into this role of prominence, and he has to try to rally the British people during the time of Hitler's rise to prominence, but he stutters, and so he enlists the use. A true story, really great story, tearjerker of a story, but, you know, I mean, it's not an action movie or anything else, but it just shows how he overcame and was able to overcome his problem of stuttering and be able to provide that kind of leadership. That's kind of inspirational, and people still look to the royal family for that kind of inspiration. But as we have seen over the last 30 or 40 years, they're humans too, and they make mistakes, and their problems have been associated with it. But slowly but surely, people began to rebel against that kind of monarchy. They did in France, and they overthrew the monarchy, and then, you know, they've had like 50,000 different types of governments since the overthrow of the French monarchy. I mean, just that's a slight exaggeration, but they've had many, many, even since World War II, they've had many, many different types of government, illustrating the prophecy about France, that it would be unstable in a political sense. During the times of monarchies, there's certainly been a concert between the church and state that have kept one another at bay. King Henry VIII was so disenchanted that the Roman church would not grant him a divorce that he founded his own church, the Church of England. And then the Catholic Church began to have less and less influence in the lives of the average Britain. Now, in verse 19, after all of this warning was given to the elders, to by Samuel, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, "Nope, but we've got to have a king over us." And they kind of had Samuel in one sense because of his son's disobedience. "That we may also be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." They had some things that they thought were pretty good about it. God allowed it, And it says, Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice, make them a king. And then he said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. And then the first king chosen was obviously somebody that was imperfect. And then after that, you had a lineage of kings and all through the nation of Israel, and then when the divided nation of the 10 nations of Israel and Judah, and Benjamin and Levi went their separate ways, you had good kings and bad kings, mostly in Israel. You had evil kings. Sometimes you'd have a good king, but most of the time they were bad. And why were they bad? Because they disobeyed the law of God, and they used that office to accrue material wealth and ignored the needs of the people and ignored God. And so captivity resulted, and for both sets of nations, and for many, many years, those nations, those peoples were lost in history. So from that time, for thousands of years, on and off through history, there was governance by kings. But the law of God was not suppressed, interestingly enough. Even through all of that deterioration, the law of God has remained today. And God allowed nations, men, people with various languages for this book to be preserved throughout all of that problem. And if there is anything that hallmarks this book, it is the demand upon the individual to be self-governed. And that is very obvious. And if you are the only one here in the audience today, the message would apply to two people, me and you, because we have to be self-governed by the law of God, which God has allowed to be preserved. And he didn't entrust its preservation to the church of God or any other church. He allowed it to be, because then, you know, somebody could always accuse the church of manipulating the text or, you know, coming up with their own laws and their own ideas and everything else. But no, it's been preserved. And even King James in 1611 saw the need for languages from which were not in common usage as much, Latin, Greek, Aramaic, that comprise the books of the Bible to be translated into modern English, thus disproving what some people have said. If the King James English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. Now, today, I use the New King James because it's a little easier. There are other translations. Most of the time I use the New King James because it's, in my view, a little more fluid, a little more accurate. And there are other translations I don't like as much, but that's the one that's my personal favorite and nice. I like that one. But from that time in ancient Israel and for most of other people, they've been governed by this unjust kind of government. And us and our nation, we have our problems and we have our difficulties, but a lot more individual freedoms than that. And I think it probably had to come to that, and God had to make it so that it would come to the point to where his word would, maybe some would say in an indirect way, would have influence over documents like the Magna Carta, in which individual rights and freedoms in the law would be expressed. And that, in other words, you couldn't just throw somebody in the dungeon and throw away the key because they didn't genuflect when the king's carriage was passing by, right? That you would have rights as individuals, and then eventually with this nation, those rights of the individual would be based in the Constitution, and which give, you know, the opportunity for the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness to the individual citizen. And many people, I'm not the one that has said it, and I'm not the one that is saying it now, but many other people a lot smarter than I am feel that this has been the major influencing document, not only in the Constitution, but for all of mankind for the last 200 years. And whether that would find general agreement in society is beside the point. I think that certainly when you examine our Constitution, you find that there are certain gifts, liberties, opportunities that are given to the individual also with that responsibility to the or that opportunity to the individual, great responsibility. So that's where we find ourselves at this particular time. But also coincidental to the rise in the influence of the Bible in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, there were other influences that began to rise. And there have been several dominant influences over the past few centuries, and all of them are rooted with the object of governance in mind. Maybe in some ways they didn't have governance or control of the individual or providing some kind of alternative guideline to the individual, but they certainly have become that way. And maybe they were born out of man's need to try to come up with something that they felt was fair. But there was the British scientist Darwin who originated the and developed this great work, genius in some ways, Origin of the Species, which promulgated the idea of his particular theory of evolution, which has basically been discredited. Let's face it, it's been widely discredited. But, you know, the roots of it still remain in terms of people's thinking, and even social Darwinism, that man is really the result of happenstance and chance. And if you're the result of happenstance, then really what effect does this law have over you if you're really not the product – if there is no God and there's not the product of God's mind here, then you know you really have the right to kind of decide for yourself what values are appropriate and proper in society. Law has no place. You know, it's random events have shaped man. And there's even the idea of social Darwinism where there is the idea that circumstances change and so must the law. And that is actually a point of view that some politicians, judges, advocates have in terms of the Constitution of the United States. It has to be a living document. Is, you know, these guys were old and, you know, I mean, we didn't have the modern technology, so we have to interpret the Constitution in light of today, even to the point to where some of you may have heard that one of our justices went to Egypt last year to advise those who were writing their new constitution. Look, don't use the U.S. Constitution as your guide. It's not an appropriate guide. And that was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'm reading from a news story here. It says, Ginsburg, whose job in the Supreme Court is to uphold the U.S. Constitution, has a curious but sadly widespread disdain for that document. A New York Times article suggested that the American Constitution is losing its allure around the world. The main reason is that it does not guarantee the right to, among other things, food, health care, and education. The founding fathers just want to give everybody a fair shot at the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, not guaranteeing food, because what do you do in a famine, or health care and education? In other words, Ginsburg and others on the left feel the Constitution is slanted too much toward preventing the government from doing things like putting people in jail without due process, and not toward requiring the government to do things like providing people with a whole array of social services that some believe it should. There have been some changes recently in society. Mr. Tanner brought to my attention a ruling, I can't remember who it was that enforced this ruling, maybe it was a Justice Department ruling that would, and it's a byproduct of the Homeland Security Act, where if you're a suspicious person, man, you can just be rounded up, put in jail. You don't have to have probable cause or any of the other legal rights that began with the Magna Carta and found their way, you know, into the Constitution of the United States, and kind of taking away the rights and the responsibilities of individuals and the responsibility of government to treat people fairly, just simply based on whether or not you are perceived to be a threat. So at any rate, the news story goes on to say, someday nature is going to take care of the attitude of somebody like Justice Ginsburg. She's not going to live forever, but it says that her attitude suggests that the U.S. Senate should be far more stringent in its confirmation process, ensuring the courts are filled with people with a better regard for the Constitution than Ginsburg has expressed. Well, good luck for that. But getting back to your responsibility as a Christian in whatever society you find yourself in, the law of God is a law of liberty for the individual, and you can be subject to that. And I think any of us, after reading the Constitution, would find, yeah, it's probably the best that man can do. It's flawed, probably, but as a document of man, it's certainly not something to be disdainful of, because you can see genius as a part of it. And I remember the first time that I saw, went to the Library of Congress and saw the Constitution and preserved by glass, you know, about that thick, and just looking at it, and that original document, and seeing it, and just thinking about the greatness of our country. And this is even as a little kid, and seeing that for the first time, long before ever became involved in the church, and thinking that something that has existed for that long and still is, captures the essence of brilliance over 200 years. Just amazing. The elders of Samuel's day didn't understand the rule of law and how it applied to them as individuals. They had individual requirements that they had failed in. And so did Samuel, to be honest. He had similar obligations, but he failed too. I mean, obviously he wasn't perfect, and I'm not disdaining him that for that. I mean, I'm sure the man was converted, but any of us have problems even though we may be converted. So as you view what's happening within society and even in this day, maybe this is an accurate gauge, maybe it's not. How many people as a percentage in a society actually hold themselves responsible to the rule of law? And maybe that's one way of analyzing current events and how many people are going to take responsibility and ownership of the law in their own lives. I don't know how many there are. I mean, there is the seedier side, and the prophecy says in Timothy that evil men will wax worse and worse. And obviously, unless there is swift justice in some cases, then people are emboldened to do the things that are wrong. And, you know, there can be chaotic behavior within society as a result when an unjust work or a law is broken and it's not properly addressed by law. Is the predominant view in society one in which places government more in charge of individual behavior? That's another way of looking at the same process, the same thing. So it boils down to, I believe, that fundamental precept. When you're evaluating the situation that we live in and when you're evaluating how you're going to respond in the society that you live in and what your responsibilities are within it. Now, prophecy shows, Revelation 13 shows that the world is headed for an abyss. It is headed for some very, very difficult times because essentially there is coming a time in which the ability of a nation like the one that we live in to forestall this is going to be severely limited. I mean, we are in a world of hurting right now as a nation. We are, what, $15 trillion in debt, and how the economy is being held together with baling wire and glue and string is beyond me. It is a shell game. It is a confidence game. It is very, very shaky. It is very, very scary. I may have said something like this 30 years ago in preaching a sermon, but I have never been more fearful about the times that I live in than right now. And not that we have famine or pestilence at the door either. It's just that the specter of so many horrible things is right on the horizon that it's amazing that it is holding together. But when we turn to Revelation 13, we find what John is on the Mediterranean Sea and falls into a vision and seeing and describing in this colorful language and terminology, this beast language, of what the world is going to come to very shortly. And it's going to be plunged into an absolute cavern and an abyss of understanding. And soon this might makes right mentality around the world is going to return. And the divine right of kings to be able to, you know, call for life and death in whatever instance they desire is going to be returned to them. And it may not be called kings, it may be called presidents, but there are going to be 10 rulers, yes, as Mr. Tuck indicated, Europe. This is where Europe is located, looking out towards Europe in the Mediterranean Sea. And this beast, this power, this government arises, and he has unbelievable power and authority. Now, unless there is supernatural help, you know, guaranteed Europe cannot possess this kind of power, because there has been nothing in their government or history that indicates that they would be able to operate in a free market and be competitive with kind of even more regulations and government intrusion in their lives than we do here. And so the economics of it are going to be even more manipulated than we have in our country. And the greatness and the power is going to be ascribed to something other than just natural resources and natural events. It's going to have to be because of their ability to overpower others and extract the wealth of other nations from them in a forceful way, because it just doesn't make sense from an economic standpoint. They do not have the model which has been really successful. I mean, they've proven that over the last 60 years. And now some nations have. Germany has, certainly. They've been able to kind of navigate this government and business kind of coalition better than most. But all the rest of them are social democracies that are failing far faster and far greater than the social mechanisms that we have created in this country, which, you know, just projecting out to the future, there are obligations that cannot be met. So a joke for those of you that are on Social Security, I'm working for you every day too right now. But all joking aside, if you to project into the future, it is a model that it wasn't intended to be a Ponzi scam to begin with in the 30s, but that's what it's become. It cannot sustain itself. And Europe is worse. The weaker economies of Europe are failing, and they're only being propped up by the world being awash with cash and pumping it into those economies. But someday, it's all going to have to be paid. And it's either a forgiveness or debt, which is great for the person that's in debt, or it's going to be an enforcement of taking wealth from others, which personally I believe is – I don't know how it all works out, but that's just a general outline. But we see this beast arising. In verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and all authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. That means the whole world. If you've got that kind of authority and you've got that kind of power and you've got the power of Satan behind you, you have the ability, the forcefulness, and the will to extract wealth from others, which I believe will be done. It doesn't talk about a lot of different wars here, but I believe there'll be many as time approaches, and Revelation 14, 15, 16 indicate that. And verse 11 shows this other beast, which is obviously a religious one. It has two horns. It looked like a lamb. It spoke like a dragon. So it's infused with all of the inspiration of the devil, and it has masqueraded itself as the church of God, the church of Christ, backed up by miraculous signs. Unbelievable. And deceives, verse 14, those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast which was wounded by the sword and lived. And he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. There was a time, there's books, I've got a book in my shelf at home, Michelangelo's the Pope's Ceiling, the story about Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel. There was a time that popes went into war. They had armies. A lot of people never were taught this in their history classes. They were generals, abject generals that took armies to war. And that time is coming back. Not that popes will actually lead the charge or anything, but, you know, it's the time is coming. And so juxtapose that with Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 1 says, "The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem." Now, I believe in Isaiah 2 and Isaiah 9, there are some fundamental problems with some of the things that I have heard expounded from time to time. And I've heard them during feast days and, you know, different times. You know, we may not have had the opportunity to fully understand, you know, what is going to transpire there, but, and we don't live in God's kingdom now, but at least we have some semblance that peoples who have lived for centuries before us never had. That is, the opportunity for an individual to own a business and to go to work and, you know, to, you know, in our society, to have an opportunity to develop and to grow and to be successful. There are more of those things that have happened in our society than in the last 50, 60, 100 years than has ever happened for mankind in all the previous thousands of years prior to that time. But it says, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, or government, mountain and government are synonyms in prophecy especially, shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. So after this time is over in Revelation 13 and Christ come back and, you know, defeats the beast power and throws the false prophet and the beast into the lake of fire, which will burn them up immediately, and there'll be ashes on the feet of the wicked, as explained by Mr. Tuck earlier in the sermonette, then people are going to come and say, all right, there's got to be something else better. And they're going to come to God and understand that there are individual responsibilities and individuals coming as entire nations will realize that they've been had for their entire history. And they've had all kinds of legislation, bureaucratic bungling and thievery and manipulation of funds and everything. And, you know, that is not even the worst of it. They've been mismanaged and misled. And it matters who you know, not what you know at times. And they're going to be absolved of all of that constraint and control. And they're going to be given an opportunity to be productive. And I believe that from the time of the millennium all the way up until the time when Satan is let loose for a little season, you're going to see such dynamic innovation and, you know, unbelievable technological advancement for 1,000 years, for instance, and right and appropriate. But everybody's going to want to follow the God of Jacob, and because they're going to recognize that this doesn't enslave, not like all the philosophers said, it doesn't enslave you. It frees you. It gives you opportunity and it helps you to understand your responsibilities. You know, I can't remember who was it, Alexis de Tocqueville, who said that government which is best governs the least, or one of those philosophers. I believe that's probably true, because if you're not motivated as an individual to be subservient to God and his laws, then you're ungovernable. You're not somebody that can be productive. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore. So that's productive in its own sense, when you eliminate all of that unnecessary fighting and expense associated with wars, just unbelievable waste, all the carnage and everything else. That's going to be done away with. And then in Isaiah 9 and verse 6, I think a fundamental misunderstanding of verse 7, but we'll begin in verse 6. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And I go back to John 1 and verse 1. There was a time in which the Father, the Son, had developed their plan for all eternity, and it had been present and it was ready to be enacted. And one moment, God and the Son were there together, and the next moment, one of them divested themselves into the womb of Mary and took on the form of a human being. It's one of the most incredible, amazing things. And John tells the story. It's a beautiful story, and it began the time of a liberation for all of mankind, which we're going to celebrate this week. It is sobering, as was mentioned in the opening prayer, but it's a wonderful thing. It says, his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. So you shouldn't read into that such an incredibly growing ever bureaucracy that is going to be stifling and looking in over people and guarding over them and watching over their every action to the point to where there's so many constraints and so many rules and regulations. No, there will be 10 very important main rules and another little applications that are already here. They've been here all along, and they are incumbent upon individuals, and individuals will learn responsibility and will be blessed because of that. But the increase is going to be that as year by year goes through in the millennium, everyone's going to get in line, and then it's just going to get better from that point forward. David will be king over his kingdom, and to order it and establish it with judgment and justice, unlike what happened during the time of the judges, from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And I have to imagine that God is very anxious to enact this and to make it a reality for all of mankind. Now, we are in a period in our democracy. It really doesn't matter. I mean, we're going to come to it at some point or another, where you know, we have been flirting with the idea that God is out of the picture, at least in the minds of those who believe in a model which has actually been around for several hundred years, that the government should be kind of your ultimate, what you ultimately look to for virtually everything. And we're kind of experimenting with that. Other nations have experimented with that, and you can't have it both ways. You can't have individual freedoms, and you can't have the government telling you everything that you need to do, or you have to be self-governed. But, you know, Christ said in John 18 and verse 36 to Pilate just before he was crucified, "My kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom is not of this world, and neither is your citizenship of this world if you are a Christian." Philippians 3 and verse 15 says, or I'm going to skip ahead to verse 17, "Brethren, join in following my example and note those who so walk as you have us for a pattern. For many walk, as I have told you often and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame." This is even in the church, that he had to warn them that there were problems within the church of God at that particular time who really didn't get it, who really didn't understand their role and responsibility as individuals, and they weren't self-governed by the law of God. He went on to say in verse 20, "Our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body, that it may be conformed to his glorious body according to the working by which he is able even to subdue all things to himself." And that is what we look forward to. No matter what government, no matter what society has in store for you, your responsibility is to God, to be individually governed by the law of God. And there is no government, church, or state, or anything else that can do anything for you that you're not willing to be subject to for yourself. So I know that there is a political season that's going on. I know that it's charged with emotion. It's kind of unfortunate. You know, we'd all like, you know, I think most people would just like the government to get out of their way. Well, it hasn't really since the time of the Garden of Eden. It's kind of been obstructive, obtrusive, and it's been problematic for many, many people, you know, even going back to the origin of Israel's history, and it hasn't gotten any better. But it's going to get better, and someday soon.